The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you wonder if Christianity is really relevant anymore. Oh, sure, maybe back in the days of ancient Rome, a religion about forgiveness and brotherhood and sisterhood, it did serve as an alternative to the pagan corruption that they had back in those days, corruption such as the gladiator games. But nothing like that could happen today, right? Well, my friend, if you think nothing like that could happen today, you kid yourself. Yes, certainly human technology has evolved, but human nature is as barbaric as ever. Some of the worst atrocities ever committed in human history have taken place in the 20th and 21st centuries. The Holocaust, the acts of terrorism where people are beheaded simply for speaking against the state or the state's religion. Oh yeah, sure, Bob, but that isn't quite the same as institutionalizing violence into a sport. Oh no? Ever hear of a boxing match? Oh, Bob, that's not to the death. Okay, then let me play my final card here. Perhaps you've been following the Hunger Games movies. I know, you don't need to say it. It's fiction. Yes, it's fiction at the moment. But will it remain fiction? Or does the insightful author of the Hunger Games notice our trends with reality shows, mixed with the fact that human nature has not changed, sobered by the reality that games to the death were already once part of ancient Western civilization for many centuries? Here to explore this issue with me, to critique not only the message of the Hunger Games films, but the art, the writing, the acting, the cinematography, the boxes of hot tamales, Reese's Pieces, and Junior Mints that you eat while watching, film critic and short story writer Mark Boubian. Mark, welcome to our program.
Thanks, Bob. No comment on the candy today, I must say, but we can't talk about the Hunger Games. No problem there.
Well, just mentioning that candy is making me hungry.
Yeah, that's... Well, I actually like 2 out of 3, but, you know, like I said, so no comment.
We got some hunger, but no games yet.
Right. There you go. To start our games, though, maybe I thought we could maybe talk about a couple of the Academy Award movies, because that was just a couple of weeks ago. And instead of going over all 10 and then doing the Hunger Games, I might be a good idea to cut down the list to maybe just 2.
Well, and since it's 2 weeks away now, probably not as much enthusiasm about
that. Right. And yeah, who knows? I mean, I wasn't that enthusiastic before. Still not that enthusiastic, unfortunately.
You still haven't seen Her yet, have you?
No, that's the movie
that
I wanted
to see. That was one of the nominees
most.
I think you would like. Yeah. We won't review it today, but I'll give a shout out for her.
Right. And Spike Jonze is one of my favorite directors. I love the movie Being John Malkovich. Did not agree with the message, but it's an absolutely outstanding
movie. Yeah, I didn't like
movie.
The message either, but as far as originality goes,
oh,
you had to say it was a work of art. Yes,
yeah.
It was hilarious. It was entertaining.
Right. So, it's a movie I recommend to everybody, but again, you don't have to agree with the message, but that's the way art is. Gravity is a movie that I was really looking forward to seeing kind of take the Academy Awards. I really expected it to.
Well, in a sense that it swept, it did win more Academy Awards than any other movie.
This year,
the one that sweeps also takes the trophy for Best Picture.
Yeah, and you know,
this time it didn't happen.
It didn't, but that's okay. Because for me, actually, Gravity really deserved one award the most of all, and I would have been very disappointed if it hadn't won. I believe it was... Before Thanksgiving, you had a guest host, and I was on with him, Mike Friedenberg.
Mike Friedenberg, yeah. Yes.
We just briefly met. I went over Gravity and I said that I felt it was probably the best directed movie I'd ever seen. And I really still think that it's just so well directed because there's so little action and dialogue that's it's not a super dynamic film. So you spend a lot of time with one character and you also spend a lot of time, imagine this, in space where there's no sound and not a heck of a lot really happens in space.
The only other movie that I thought gave us a realistic depiction of space by removing the musical soundtrack was 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Correct, yeah. The Firefly movie, Serenity, is one of the other movies to actually portray space somewhat accurately, but that's about it. And from a science fiction fan standpoint, as someone who likes physics, Gravity had very good, accurate as you could possibly be and still maintain a story in terms of effects, but just the way Alfonso Cuarón did things, the spinning out of control and then transitioning the camera from outside the helmet to inside the helmet and giving you a sense of the intensity going from dead silence to the heavy breathing, those touches like that were just really impressive. And for him to be able to pull off a movie like this, I think is just, it just says so much about what a quality director he has. And one of my favorite movies, a very heavy movie, very difficult to watch. I enjoyed it the first time I've seen it. It's not one of those movies you go throw on and have some popcorn. Children of Men, an absolutely outstanding movie. Also, one of the best directed movies I've ever seen. Not a single flaw in that film. It is absolutely outstanding.
And I saw that movie based on your recommendation, yeah. And it was absolutely excellent.
Yes, it was. And so he was recognized sort of popularly as a good director for that film, but I don't think he was really, I don't know if he was critically acclaimed for it, but he didn't receive an award for it. This time around, I think he really deserved it. He stepped it up just a little bit above Children of Men. So a very good movie. And I mean, now saying best directed movie, it's a tough call because it's an unusual film. And in terms of it being a lot of computer animation and a lot of mix between live action and animation. So is he an animator or a director? You know, it's a tough thing to kind of separate in this type of film. And there's always going to be Stanley Kubrick, David Lean, and even modern guys like Wes Anderson or the other Anderson, Paul Thomas Anderson, who did Magnolia and Boogie Nights. Those guys are outstanding directors in their own right. It was just something about this movie what seems so difficult and so well communicated in a way that I didn't think would be possible. I just really felt it was an outstanding film.
So, well, you know, Mark, they absolutely pulled it off. And when I saw the previews for that in the theater, I remember saying to myself, there's no way we're going to watch Sandra Bullock in space for 2 hours.
Right.
Talk to yourself. So I just assumed that, and I would have done this if I had directed it. Lucky thing I didn't direct it. I was assuming that we were going to see flashbacks and things.
Oh, yeah.
And they pulled it off, though. She was in space the whole time. There was never a dull moment. You weren't bored. It was an amazing thing. So we actually experienced that, I guess for the most part, in real time. I think there were a few places where they telescoped ahead, but it was more or less in real time from what I recall.
And there were the flashbacks were actually handled as
stories.
They didn't really
have any flashbacks.
Yeah, they told you about their...
She was talking. Yeah, they would talk about their past.
Yeah, so it was natural.
Yes, there was exposition, absolutely, right. Like what you would get in a play. But this was almost like a stage play, but with special effects. I could see this whole thing being done on stage.
Yeah, actually, I agree, except for a couple of scenes near the end where, you know, I don't want to give away too much, but whatever. There's some really good special effects that would not work on a stage unless you wanted to burn the theater down, I guess.
A little bit the way of Cabaret. The musical Cabaret was up against The Godfather that particular year, and that was known as the year of The Godfather. The Godfather got nominated for everything. Cabaret swept the Oscars with 8 wins. The Godfather still won Best Picture of the Year, Best Actor for Marlon Brando, which he turned down by sending Princess Littlefeather up to.
Oh, that was that year. Oh, I didn't know
and
that.
And then also Best Director, Francis Ford Coppola, prestigious categories to be sure. But it was Cabaret that swept, and it won the unenviable distinction of being the movie that won the most Oscars without actually winning Best Picture. And to this day, people still remember it as the year of the Godfather, and they don't even think about Cabaret. But that was Cabaret's night.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. And hopefully that doesn't happen to Gravity, because the movie that did win, 12 Years a Slave, I'm not super thrilled with.
And now, I saw that just a few days ago, knowing we were going to review it.
Right.
I thought it was a good movie, well made. It wasn't. It certainly wasn't an entertaining movie, but who would expect it to be?
Right. It's about slavery, and it's not a nice movie about slavery where they're singing songs and picking cotton. That's, well... Actually, is there any movie like that? I don't know.
There shouldn't be a movie about slavery. But it is kind of interesting. I mean, what do you expect when you see a movie about slavery? I'm trying to imagine who would have gone to that going, oh, wow, shoot, slavery was a bad thing.
Yeah.
Let me write this down. This is quite a tale. I mean, of course, it was an intense, disturbing movie because slavery was an intense, disturbing practice.
Yeah. Now, some of the things I don't like about the movie. Now, obviously, slavery is how many years ago? 150, 200 years ago almost. I think the movie takes place in 1850, so I don't want to do the math. But
1850 was approximately 10 years or so before the Civil War.
Okay.
That was in the 1860s. I'm kind of ballparking.
All right, so there you go. So there's your history lesson for the day. I was not good at dates. But everything about the movie felt like 2014, or I should say 2013, because that's when it was made. A good example is the use of the N-word. Now, I know that that was what people said back then, and I just felt like as the movie started, they were saying it to, like, hit you with it. You know, like, this is the... We're such bad people. We're going to say this word. And they almost like pause and wink at you. Yes, we went there. We said that word. And back in the 1800s, this word would have been casually sort of tossed out. That's the way I think that it would have gone. And that's the way I've seen it portrayed in the past, the way I've heard it described. And even in more modern times, in the 19s, in the 20th century, people were still using the word casually.
Well, African-Americans use it amongst themselves casually all the time.
Yeah, today, a very good example. So it didn't ring true because it was a way to cast these people very quickly as being evil, and they say it in such a way that it hits you. Now, one thing I've got to thank my parents for to no end is I was raised hating that word. I don't think there's a word that offends me anywhere near that particular word.
I have to say the same thing. My parents were Democrats in the mid-60s. I think the Democratic Party was a better party back then. Being liberal really meant being liberated.
Yeah.
And with all the dysfunction in my family, they did a wonderful job of speaking against racism.
Right.
The same thing, forbidden word. And so as a little kid, I was raised knowing that was wrong. And so it's good. It's good that we had this.
Right. And I'm glad that I'm responding to the word.
Well,
Mark, imagine
the kind of review we'd be given this movie if we didn't have those kinds of upbringings.
Oh, my gosh.
It could be pretty bad.
Yes, right.
So we've got to thank our parents right now.
But then we'd be famous because we'd be all over the internet. Everybody would be like, hey,
I don't want to be that famous on the internet.
But, and I think, though, what I'm saying about this particular, the use of this word, I think kind of embodies how I felt about the whole movie. It just felt like 2013 saying slavery is bad, and here's a movie about slavery being bad in 2013, and it just, everything about it just pulled me out of the movie. And I went in kind of jaded thinking, oh, you know, that it's a movie about racism, and I'm gonna, you know, it's another movie about racism. Not that there's anything wrong with that. It's just that, you know, it was sold as a movie about racism, and I wasn't that interested.
Do you feel that maybe it won the award for that agenda?
Okay, that's a good question. That's exactly why I think it won the award. A great example of another movie about racism.
So everybody's voting for Gravity for everything else, and then they get to that one, they go, whoa, we better not do Gravity this time.
Right, exactly.
Of course, it is a secret ballot, so they could have said, who's going to find out?
Yeah, right. Well, I don't know. Maybe they sell. I don't want to speculate. Okay, let's not go down that road. Okay, a good example, Brokeback Mountain. I don't know what year it was, a couple years ago, 4 or 5 years ago. The Favorite, going to win the Best Picture.
It did win Best Director for Ang Lee.
There you go, 2006. Thank you very much. So Yeah, it didn't win because this other movie that it just so happened everybody in Hollywood was in. So which movie are you going to vote for? The one you're in or that other one?
Oh, that was the one about the car crash, wasn't
it? That's right. Crash.
It was just called Crash.
Ironically enough, yeah, that's what it's called, Crash. But it was a good movie. The weird thing about that movie, what I heard about it, this is a movie about slavery. Guess what? That's what the movie was really about. It was about slavery. This movie is about a slave, but the theme is about slavery in 12 Years a Slave.
It was a little different. Now, one thing that was different that I found interesting, though, is that this was a movie about somebody who lived in the North, who was a free man and was kidnapped and made a slave.
Yeah.
Now, that was an interesting twist because I hadn't
heard anything about
many
that.
Stories. And I started thinking, I remember when they said, show us your papers. How easy would it be for someone to just even look at somebody's papers and just tear them up?
Right.
And what are you going to do? It's not like he gets out his iPhone and orders up another copy online in those days. So I had not thought much about, but it must have been a hellish nightmare even for the African Americans that lived in the North.
Oh, man, I know. And I mean, there must have been a big business in kidnapping people and selling them. I mean, even
absolutely.
Today.
It was cheaper than the slave trade coming down through the ships. All they had to do is go into New York City or something.
Right. That's a good point right there. Yeah. Oh, man.
So that was kind of harrowing. I did feel that I would have wanted to see more about this gentleman's life, his good life, his free life, more with his family, because, you know, I would have related to it more. It so quickly gets to the part of the story where he's kidnapped, and we realize he's had a good life. But if we had seen more of it, then the contrast between the gentleman that he was and what they were turning him into would have been far more striking. So
yeah.
I thought that we could have had a little more from his past.
Right. I kind of do agree with that. A little less, you know, we're whipping you again. Then, you know, because it was pretty awful. Though, of course, you want to the intensity of that is important to convey of being whipped. So I didn't like watching it, but I think it's a necessary part of the movie. So
well, I didn't like watching Passion of the Christ either,
right,
but I felt that everybody should see that movie at least once.
See, and that's a good example of where that the violence does convey something important. And in this movie, even though I would rather have seen more about his life, artistically, it probably was a better decision if you were going to pick one or the other to leave the very violent stuff in.
I do think we could compare this a little bit to The Help that came out a few years ago, because probably there was an agenda behind that too. But one thing I liked about The Help, in fact, I loved that movie. I said over the air that I got teary-eyed and moved while I watched it. But they didn't demonize everybody.
Right.
Even though they were in the South, there were racist white people in the South, and there were people that lived in the South that didn't like what was going on.
Right.
With the Jim Crow laws. And that was true even in the Civil War era. An excellent movie that nobody watches anymore. It was called Shenandoah with Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah. I've never seen it.
He was the head of a family that lived. Now, this was fiction, but it was fiction true to the time. This was a family that lived in the South, but they did not believe in slavery. And they protested it as people living in the South. We always think that, oh, it's everybody in the North is pure and everybody in the South was evil. I like it when they don't just dramatically demonize everybody or make everybody into an angel, that there's shadows, there's gray areas.
Yes, and exactly. Okay, here's my comparison movie for 12 Years a Slave. Not to Crash, because Crash did a good job of showing real people struggling with real racism and real, what we would call as Christian sin. This movie, they're caricatures.
I mean, comparing it to The Help, not to Crash.
No, I'm not going to compare it to The Help either. I'm going to compare it to
You're comparing
Django
it to that movie
Unchained.
About Crash.
I'm comparing 12 Years a Slave to the movie Django Unchained.
Okay. I thought I heard you say the word Crash in there, and you're going back to the
I'm not
Crash
comparing
movie.
It to Crash.
Sorry
about
maybe
that.
Maybe I misunderstood you.
Well, okay.
Stranger things have happened.
Yes, that's true. So Django Unchained.
I loved Django Unchained.
Yeah, it was, I had mixed feelings about it, but the thing about Django Unchained.
It was vintage Quentin Tarantino.
Whatever, yeah. But you're not seeing a movie that's an accurate depiction of the South when you see
Quentin
Django Unchained.
Quentin Tarantino's never accurate.
Of course.
Did you see what he did with Inglourious?
Yes.
I don't think I can say the word name of the movie over the air.
Yes.
Inglourious, you know what.
Well, they spelled it differently, so you can, right?
Yeah, but they don't know how we're spelling it on the radio.
But,
where's George Carlin when we need him?
Yeah, right. There you go. His words, his list. But the thing is, like I said, the Django, you're not expecting to go see a movie that's really nuanced. You're seeing a movie about, I mean, it was a vengeance they refer to vengeance porn is the term, I think.
Well, he loves anachronism. Yeah. You even have contemporary music in the Western when it's Clinton.
Right, it's surf music. That's
awesome.
He plays
whatever he wants to play.
Yeah. But 12 Years a Slave, unfortunately, almost every white person is that same person and has an equivalent guy in Django. Now, that is a terrible comment to make about this movie, and I'm making it because he just didn't flesh any white person out very much. Except
it was just they were white, they were evil.
Right, except for the one guy who paid for the movie. What's his name again? Oh, Brad Pitt. That's right. Yeah, I'll be in your movie, but you know, I'm not gonna be the bad guy. I'm gonna be the good guy because I am the good guy.
Unlike Roots, where we had all these people like Chuck Connors and Lloyd Bridges who'd been Doug McClure who'd been heroes on TV. But they were all willing to play the bad guy.
Yeah.
Seems like today an actor is, no way, I'm playing the bad guy. I got to be the macho guy that saves the day.
Yeah, well, I think, unfortunately, a lot of things do end up becoming about image and stuff like that. And so I can see Brad Pitt caring about his image and wanting to come across as a very positive role model in the movies and out.
Well, then maybe he should have thought of that when he made the movie California. That wasn't exactly a heroic image.
Yeah, well, that was like his first movie, but he was awesome in that.
He did a great job, but he was sure playing a bad guy.
Yes, he was. So he can play a bad guy. But this is, you know, the reinvented Brad Pitt. I don't know. I guess I'm a little cynical about Hollywood just because sometimes I can kind of see what I think are the politics making its way into the movie. And when I see that, or when I perceive that, it's going to pull me out of the movie. And that, unfortunately, 12 Years a Slave, all tons of stuff just ripped me right out of the movie and brought me back into 2014, the year I'm in. And that's where I'm sitting, looking at 2014 politics and morality in a movie that should be about this time that it takes place, 1850. Sure, we can learn a lot about ourselves as modern people from it, even if you depict it accurately to the time it takes place. But unfortunately, way too much meta types of ideas making their way in. Meta in terms of outside of the story, outside of the film, making their way in. The last thing I want to say about the movie is how God is portrayed in the film. Now, every bad guy, terrible thing that happens.
Oh, that's true. They were always Bible believers.
Yeah. Yes, and over Bible verses, the one song that's not the starting of the movie, but the starting of slavery, the real caricature bad guy who should have been in Django Unchained starts singing this song about slaves running away, and he didn't use the word slave, of course, he used the other one, and then it gets superimposed over the plantation owner reading the Bible, holding a church service and reading the Bible. So we hear the song about the quote-unquote slave over the Bible verse about Jesus proclaiming to be God, and he's the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. The implication, not your God, people I'm talking to, because you're not one of us, our God, but I'm reading it to you. It just, they were really building this huge separation between the white and black,
well,
religious
and
not religious. And yeah, absolutely, they did
use this. It's true that people took certain verses in the Bible out of context, but what you don't see in Hollywood movies, and what is certainly not being taught at a lot of our universities, is that the entire abolitionist movement also was based on the Bible. Now, if they would show that side of it once in a while, that would be important.
Right.
Okay, I'm here with film critic Mark Boubian, and we will be right back.
As if you haven't figured it out by now, Bob is mildly opinionated about the ultimate issues of life. But Bob also respects the opinions of others. To offer your own viewpoint or to challenge Bob with a thought-provoking question, give us a call at 1-888-344-1170. 1-888-344-1170. You can also reach Bob through Facebook, Twitter, or questions@bobsiegel.net. When you trust the care of your children to others, it's comforting to know they share the same Christian values, that what you teach your children at home is also taught in their preschool environment. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is an all-inclusive preschool where the staff ministers to all children of all abilities, including children with special needs, through a curriculum developed by the owners and designed for the preschool-aged child 3 to 5. During these preschool years, your children will make important developmental gains, as well as social and emotional development that'll be the foundation for their overall success in life. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool is a state-licensed, Bible-believing, Bible-teaching preschool and a nonprofit 501c3 organization. Contact us now at wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com and secure a space for your preschooler. wisdomworkschristianpreschool.com or call 619-440-1044, 619-440-1044. Wisdom Works Christian Preschool.
This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785. That's 447-8785 for W&S Electric, Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric.
Do your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly. Like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. educateforlife.org. If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel, and it's always great to be joined by one of our rotating co-hosts, short story writer and film critic and good friend, Mark Boobian. Mark, welcome back to our program.
Thanks again, Bob. So let's wrap up on 12 Years a Slave. The last couple of things I want to say about it is, unfortunately, the movie does choose to show you the negative side, the bad side of Christianity, where people use God's name to justify horrific acts, which has happened.
Well, that's not the bad side of Christianity. That's a misuse of Christianity.
They're
not getting their cues from Jesus or the Bible.
Yes, that is not Christianity.
And the Bible condemns slavery, folks. It's condemned in three places in the New Testament. If you haven't heard that, you've been hearing a lot of hooey.
Okay, there you go. And pardon my slip of the tongue. That was terrible. But the movie, unfortunately, so they do not show a good, balanced, even accurate portrayal of how Christianity was in that time. Again, ripping us out of the time period and bringing us into modern times. In the Lord's name, slavery is done in the movie. In God's name, the undefined, unclear, unreal God, slavery is condemned. Unfortunately, I felt that, Brad Pitt's character who saves the day is a Christian, but as he enters the movie and all the discussions Jesus, the Lord, that person is not mentioned. And that's not accurate to the times. Sorry, it's accurate to our times, not their times. And it's too bad that that can't be something we see in the movie. Now, I think that his character does raise very good questions. Without God, without a real, loving, caring God, slavery is not wrong, since I believe in that loving, caring God who loves us all. Slavery is wrong and evil. But that is the only shoe I have to stand on, only foot I have to stand on when I make a statement like that. And interestingly enough, that's the only way the movie was able to condemn slavery. So there you go.
Well, Mark,
for the movie.
I attend Skyline Wesleyan Church. The entire Wesleyan denomination was started as an abolitionist.
Well, there movement. You go. That's awesome.
So it's not just that that's condemned in the Bible. There are whole movements that survive today that have that as a very proud part of their history.
Right, and
so
that
people
is
need to understand
heritage.
That side of it.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I appreciate that, Bob. Now, let's talk about the Hunger Games. Now, while I think that, you know, some of my problems with 12 Years a Slave, hitting you over the head with slavery and racism, yes, of course, Hunger Games, a very heavy series of books, very rich, very political, very cultural, many, many, many themes to explore, all totally relevant to our time. It's a book that takes place in the future, but it's very, very centered around the culture of the United States post 9/11.
Particularly the whole reality show culture.
The reality show is, that's actually just even our first real big in-your-face clue, to be honest. One of the things, okay, so after 9/11, now 9/11 has to be the most horrible, evil, terrible thing I have ever witnessed. I had so much trouble dealing with the horror of what I saw, and I still to this day do. I won't go see a movie that shows us 9/11 again visually because it's just too emotionally loaded for me. It's a terrible thing. What took so long for art to really reflect that? I think it was so terrible, it was hard for us to integrate that into our art. It wasn't until movies like The Dark Knight, I think that's the first really big movie to stand out as a post 9/11 movie where it takes a look at the darker side of humanity that would cause or instigate such evil. And The Hunger Games, I think, takes the politics of post 9/11, the Bush administration in particular, because that's when it was written, not necessarily a criticism of Bush per se, but that's just when she wrote the book, and it's critical of how we approach the war. But not just, hey, that guy in the White House, it's his fault. No, she's approaching it from the point of view of, look at how we are as a culture. It's not his fault. It's our fault. If there is fault in terms of politics and culture to be pointed to, if there are things we are doing wrong, it's our fault as a culture. And I have tremendous respect for that. Pointing the finger and blaming somebody else is easy. Pointing the finger at yourself and saying, I play a role in this, that's hard. And I think that's one of the awesome things about The Hunger Games. And that's without even saying what the books and movies are portraying. There's, again, so much there. And I think the politics are very broad, so you can come away hating them or loving them, regardless of what your political affiliation is. I wouldn't say it's a conservative or liberal movie or moderate movie. It's certainly not a moderate movie, that's for sure.
Well, it certainly doesn't have a high, or it's not a culture with a high view of human life.
Correct.
It's certainly, I mean, the devaluation of life that we're going through with abortions and now infanticides, I mean, it's a natural progression. And you mix that with the reality show.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's a really good point. And you make the point, and you said it at the beginning of the show, that there were the gladiators of long ago. How far are we away from that? And The Hunger Games is saying, hey, this book is not set too far in the future. It's unspecified.
They're saying it's not like we haven't gone down this road before.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not such crazy speculation on her part. I mean, she is taking cultural trends today and expounding upon them.
The most chilling part is the announcer, the MC, because he's just so slick with his hair. And he's interviewing all these people, and he knows they're all going to get killed except one, maybe two of them. And it's like, well, we really want to wish you the best out there. Yeah. You're just the best. How many are you rooting for Jim?
Right.
I mean, it's chilling to watch that.
He's a great reflection of that fake personality that we have today in society.
Yeah. That's a good
point. How many survived? Don Pardo.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, it totally reflects the fakeness of television. And you're right. I mean, we've been down this road before in our history. And so it's wholly plausible that we can go down that way again. I mean, we live in a world where celebrity boxing once existed. So, I mean, how far are we really from putting kids on TV if we're already putting wash-up celebrities on TV fighting?
Right. That's a good point. And
totally agree.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And you know, we could go down that road. Now, that is even just talking about one small aspect of our culture. That's not even about the politics at large, not even addressing what is happening overall in the book, that there's this revolution building against the corrupt and evil society. And it's a very interesting and well-done book because it just... Oh, man, the lines of good and evil are blurred to some extent, not completely. There's a bad guy, absolutely, and there are good guys, absolutely, but you'll see as things progress that it's not as easy to stay one or the
other. Well, as you said earlier, Mark, it's a better drawn character because usually, even I do believe people can become completely evil, but they become that.
Yes, they
there was a time when they were composites of good and evil,
right.
And that's where most of us are.
Right.
And it's just a much more realistic person if you don't know yet whether he's a good guy or a bad guy, because maybe he's something in between.
Right. And that's a good point. And what's really powerful about the character of Katniss Everdeen, the hero, Jennifer Lawrence plays, I think that she has the choice to go down one road or the other. And she starts out as somebody who... She hates her cat. She loves her sister. She loves her family, but she hates her cat, has problems with her mom. She hunts. She has no problem killing things. And she has no problem hating certain things and wanting to kill them. That's basically what we're introduced to at the beginning of the book. And as we progress, we see her learning to despise the killing that she is thrust into. The difference between killing an animal and killing a person is made real to her. And now she
doesn't animal rights activist might not like that distinction a whole lot.
Yeah, well, that's fine. They can give me a call and we can talk about it. That would be awesome. But that's one of the things I really like about this movie is her character is not just, she's on a journey and she's going to change. She's not going to be the same as she travels through. Now, the first movie was directed by... I've got the second movie's director. That's Francis Lawrence. And anyway, he directed, and he's not related to Jennifer Lawrence. People ask me that all the time. Is that...
Looks like Nick is looking up the other
director for
you.
I had it written down, and of course I bury it here. Okay, here it is. Okay, Gary Ross. I'm sorry, Mr. Ross. Gary Ross directed the first Hunger Games movie. Now, I didn't like the first Hunger Games movie. I read the books, loved the books.
So this is in the tradition of Lord of the Rings that we did last time.
Yeah, but I won't spend as much time. I'm just going to say that it was kind of a little bit too
You know, see, now, I didn't read the books of the Hunger Games. I saw only the movies. I'm going to have to start reading the books first so that I can dislike these movies as much as Mark.
Right.
I'm like you, Bob. I usually read the books after I watched hate the movie.
Because then the book will be better. The book will be like an expansion of the characters, whereas if you read the book first, then the movie always seems abbreviated.
Yeah, right.
You feel like you're watching the Cliff Notes.
Wow, this character is a lot more fleshed out than I remember in the movie. Wait a second. So yeah, that's, I guess, right, a good thing. I kind of compare the first Hunger Games movie, though, to it's sort of like going to Starbucks and ordering iced frappuccino with extra sugar versus a 200 proof shot of whiskey. That's the difference between the Hunger Games movie and the first Hunger Games book. And unfortunately,
wow,
it needed to be that 200 proof whiskey. Fortunately, and I will almost never say this, they changed directors. Fortunately, we went from the guy that directed Pleasantville and Seabiscuit to the guy that directed Constantine and I Am Legend. And Those are dark, dark movies in their own right. They're great, good movies, not great movies, but they're fun, dark movies. He was a much better choice, and I am so glad they switched to him because Catching Fire is an amazing, great movie. It has all of the weight.
So it was much more true to the book.
Yes, and it, not just the good thing is it is more true to the book. I don't care so much if it's true to the book, but if it is able to convey that
weight. The atmosphere. You want the atmosphere of the book to come through.
Because the book, it's just so powerful and moving, and the characters are going through so much, and it has so much to say about humanity, human life, about what is right and wrong. What do you do when you're faced with having to kill somebody? Or in this movie, the question that they're faced with, they go on this tour, they've finished the Hunger Games, they win, they're touted as heroes, but the rest of the world, kind of their world, the poor people, the people that are outcast from the primary society, the working class, the slave class, I guess would be the best way to put it, those people see them as sort of symbols of a possible revolution. And so they're being touted as heroes and marched around all of the outer districts of the slave people. And instead of being seen by the people as this, oh, they're such heroes, they're our celebrities, they're Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie, they're not like that. They're, to us, they are people like Martin Luther King or, you know, somebody like that, where they're not just celebrities, they are people here to lead
revolution.
Us. Yeah, exactly. Symbols of the revolution. So that contrast in that they, as characters, have to deal with that. Now, the problem for them, though, is that the guys that are marching them around aren't ignorant. They aren't maybe doing the smartest thing marching them around, but they aren't ignorant. So what they do is they know to put down the people that are protesting. And so in the movie, we don't see it on screen because that's not the rating the movie had, and it's for young adults, but it's still powerful that somebody that's calling out to them as a symbol is arrested, thrown down, and shot.
I actually agree. I think that's actually one of the most powerful scenes in the entire movie.
Yeah.
Was early on during that the tour in Rue's district, that scene was it, right there, you knew that it was a different ride altogether than the first one.
Yeah.
It's definitely a different thing.
Yeah, exactly. It's such a dark moment in the film, and there was nothing that even touched that in the first movie, unfortunately. And things are going to get much, much darker. Hopefully. I say hopefully because that's the way the story needs to go.
Well, do they have the same director signed up for the third one?
Thank God. I'm so glad. So hopefully, I'm sure that it will go very well. I'm expecting a good next movie. Maybe sort of like Star Wars, you know, where the first three, episode 1, 2, kind of whatever. But episode 3, that one, man, that heavy, hard, dark, turning to evil thing, Lucas nailed that one. He needed to. In this movie, they need to nail that one on the last one.
But one of the actors died, or am I thinking of a different movie?
Philip Seymour Hoffman did die.
Oh, that's who it was, of course. How could I forget Philip Seymour Hoffman? Yeah, so are they going to write his character out or have a replacement?
They're not doing either of those. I believe they have enough of him to
continue. Oh, okay.
With him. He's not the hugest character, and it's certainly, from the book, I know who the character is, but there's other characters in the book that could take the role that they're setting him up for. Like, for example, in a book, you can have 4 or 5 characters doing something. In a movie, you can't, so you put it all onto one. And I think that's what they were doing with Philip Seymour Hoffman. So one solution would be to kind of have him transfer that power, so to speak, to somebody else and have them take the role that he was going to. And it would still work fine. Maybe not quite as well as having him do that, because we do have some invested in him. But that's a good question, and I think that they'll probably handle it well. And I actually have an immense amount of trust for this director, because he really did have a good vision for this film. And one of the things that I liked about the scene we were just discussing about the man being shot is that on the characters themselves, we're watching Katniss Everdeen and PETA, her pseudo-boyfriend. He loves her. She's not so sure. There's another guy back home. That's the hook for a lot of people. That love triangle. The they, though, see themselves as the cause of this. Like, they know that it, because we're here, this guy was just killed. And so it's a very heavy thing. They're young. They just got out of this arena killing other people by killing a bunch of other people. And to them, it was just survival. Now they're being touted as heroes and celebrities. And people are being killed because of them. How do you deal with that? That's a very dark and heavy thing to face. And I think the great thing about the movie is we start to see it weigh, especially on Katniss Everdeen. Now, in a couple of weeks, I think, or pretty soon, there's, like the Academy Awards, there's a Kids' Choice Awards. I watch this every year with my children. Sometimes it's really fun. When Jack Black hosts it, it's awesome. And
well,
other
Jack
people
Black
are not
makes
as
anything
awesome.
Fun.
Okay, so he's not hosting it this year, unfortunately, but we voted for, you know, the movies and books and sports people that we like. You know, there's a category for everybody. So they have funny kid-oriented categories. Not best actress, but best butt kicker. So for the Kids' Choice Award this year, and I believe they did it with the Hunger Games too, they have best female butt kicker award. And two of the people that are listed are from the Hunger Games movie, Catching Fire. One of them is a secondary female character who actually, it's almost appropriate to have her there. But the other butt kicker is Katniss Everdeen. She's probably going to win because she's a great character.
Well, and she is excellent. You know, she is so good that when I saw the movie that she won the Oscar for, Silver Linings Playbook, and I had already seen the first Hunger Games movie, I wasn't familiar with her name as an actress. I did not know till the second movie came out that that had been the same person. So I'm testifying not so much to my ignorance, which that too, but what an incredible actress she was, because
right.
you could
she's
not
fantastic.
Have found two roles more. She's like a female Dustin Hoffman or Robert Duvall.
Right. She's a chameleon. Yes. Yeah. And so now we're commenting on her acting. However, the category is not best female actress.
Oh, it's female butt kicker.
True. Now, how much butt does she go out and kick in the arena? I mean, that's what it's all about, getting in there and kicking
butt.
There
was a plethora of butt in that movie.
Yes,
that
there
kicked.
Was, but, sorry, that was a Freudian slip.
We didn't mean to make that bad
yes,
pun.
Yes, that was a terrible pun. Okay.
Unintentional
however,
bad pun.
However, from Katniss's point of view, she despises every single death in the movie. She feels the weight of every single one. And I think that that is so much to the new director's credit, that he's communicating the trouble that she is having with having to kill. The first movie didn't really get that across. This movie has done a much better job, Catching Fire, the second movie, much better job of conveying Katniss's despair of having to kill. She has to. It's
well,
us or them.
She didn't
seem
too wild about that in the first movie,
no,
either, from what I recall.
She's sort of not wild about it, but she's going for it anyway.
Well,
because
she wanted to protect
it.
Her sister.
Yeah.
I think she was thinking more about that she was replacing her sister in the
Correct.
First movie.
Now, I'm not even just talking about the buildup in that movie. I'm talking about the actions and what she does outside. The only moment that I really felt like Katniss was kind of dreading and hating and not wanting to go into the arena, really, really thoroughly feeling it, was when she's being raised up into the arena in the first movie. That's the only time in that movie where I felt like she really doesn't want to be there and she doesn't like the idea of what's happening. It's not just, I don't want to be here because I'm going to be killed. It's, I don't want to be here because I don't want to kill other people. They are valuable. They are important. There's something about killing other people. That's why after being in an arena and killing a whole bunch of kids, they go on tour. And when somebody is shot in front of them, they don't just let it go. It's no big deal. He just got shot. They are torn apart because it's such a terrible thing.
Well, and it's not
killing
just,
is a terrible thing.
It's not just the question of, do I want to kill other people? But in this gladiator-style theme of if I don't kill, I will be killed. So we're dealing with not only choices of good and evil, but how much are we willing to sacrifice? Are we willing to lay down our life? And when you given the popularity of this book with middle schoolers primarily, these books and these films, for them to be raising those kinds of questions to that age, this is what You know, I know you and I believe in the purity of art. We right. hate it when art's just commercial. This is what pure art is all about. This right. is what art is supposed to do. It's supposed to be a mirror that looks into the human soul.
Right. And, you know, I come on here, Bob, and I talk mostly about commercial movies, actually. Like 12 Years a Slave, not a commercial movie, but it won an Academy Award, so I'm talking about it. But typically, you know, I'll come on and I'll probably talk about the Transformers.
But you look for themes in depth. Even in Transformers, you
found
some stuff.
Absolutely, because there's almost always something there. And that's the beauty even of commercial art, that it still is art. Maybe not quite to the depth of a Wes Anderson movie, but still. This movie walks the line really well. Every once in a while, you do get a movie like this where it is both commercial and
artistic.
There's
enough action and entertainment and romance to bring in the groupies, but they're raising questions that may not be raised with them in another context.
Right. And so what's interesting to me, and here's, we could talk about how this reflects on our culture. All of this discussion I've had about Katniss's view of life as being important, as being, she holds the sanctity of life in her heart. You can see it in her actions and her expressions, everything that Jennifer Lawrence is a great actress is able to convey, as the story conveys. And yet, our culture, the real culture that watches this movie, calls her a butt kicker. I think that that is a really powerful comment on missing the point, part one, and also
absolutely.
Maybe just wanting to whitewash the point and only see, you know, the fun stuff. Let's not deal with the heavy stuff.
If they gave the butt kicker word to a movie like Kick-Ass, that'd be a little bit different. You
know? Exactly. And that movie actually has a very heavy moral kind of thing to it, too. That's a movie. I didn't see the second one, unfortunately. I love the first one. I can't believe
it was a fun movie, but they weren't raising the kinds of questions that the Hunger Games
not to
are.
This level, but it was a movie about vengeance, and it does ask, how far are you going to go
for
vengeance?
Yeah.
And, you know, so there is something to be taken away from it, but right, not to this level. There's not. I mean, everywhere you look in the Hunger Games, there is a question to be asked. And when I read the books, I was like, how in the heck did this book get so popular with kids? It's amazing. How would it get popular with adults even? I mean, it's just so harrowing and tragic. It's, I mean, come on, Romeo and Juliet, and that's like popcorn. This is heavy stuff. I mean, you know, the great tragedies of Shakespeare have nothing on the Hunger Games. Sorry, Shakespeare, but that's the way it is. It's really heavy duty.
You know, I hear Shakespeare passed away not too long ago, too.
Okay.
You know, they say actors die in three, so we had Philip Seymour Hoffman and then Shakespeare.
Yeah, right. Oh, if only Philip Seymour Hoffman.
So he's not around to be offended by that comment.
Yeah, right. There you go. Okay. Well, I don't think I'll ever offend Shakespeare ever. So that's okay. But I really don't have anything bad to say about the new movie because it is so well done. You know, the only bad thing I'm even saying is the previous movie just didn't quite raise it to the level that it needed to be.
And yet, if you
Thank
hadn't
God,
read the book
did.
And you had seen it as a movie in its own right, you would have thought it was a well-made movie.
I would have thought it was an okay movie. I would have kind of... I still feel like it was a little too foofy, a little too easy. And to be honest, Bob, I really don't know if I could answer a question like that where... to me, this...
Because it's too hypothetical. That was not your experience.
Right, and because I'm so caught up, so deeply entrenched in who the characters are, what the story's about, what happens, how hard things can be for these poor characters, that I can't separate myself from those aspects and say, well, the directing was good because they set it up this way or that way or whatever. Those kind of things, I'm just not going to be aloof enough to watch that and see it that way, unfortunately. I think it's still a worthwhile movie to see. You do need to see it to see the next one and to learn who the characters are. So it's still an okay movie, but see the Hunger Games first movie for the second one, Catching Fire, and hopefully the third one, Mockingjay, which should be awesome.
And that's being released, what, about a year from now?
A year from now. Next summer, I believe. But it may be two parts. I still am not clear on whether
they're going to go the way of Harry Potter and do
part one, part two. Yeah, but it would be a good movie to do that with, so I'm for
it. It would be artistically, because you can include more of the book, but that won't be the reason the producers are doing it. They'll be doing it because they want to sell more of those hot tamales and Reese's Pieces.
That's right.
All right. Well, Mark, it's always great having you on. We will have you on again really soon. This is Bob Siegel, and I will see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.